to the Talk of Gasoline Alley. I'm David Deering, right here on 107.5 and 1070. The Fan, the IMS historian, right across from me, Donald Davidson. Donald, good evening. How are you?
David, I'm fine. Thank you very much.
Can you believe we're just 4 days away?
I know.
I mean, it's it feels like just yesterday I was getting ready for the 100th, and here we are, just a few.
Oh yeah, well, all
few
the
sleeps
spring,
away.
All the spring that you know, when we were going around doing the visits to the different communities and everything, and it just seems like it's 2 months away. But I knew it would go in a hurry.
This month has gone by fast.
Sure
as well.
Has. Yeah.
Well, hey, let's not waste any more time here.
Okay.
Let's get to John in Plainfield. John, you're first up tonight. What's your question for Donald Davidson?
Hi, guys. And you're right. It's been a fast month. It seems like we were just shoveling snow. I attended the discussion at the museum that you hosted last night, Donald, with Scott Goodyear and Alan Zer Jr. Great event. One of the highlights of the month so far. And the topic came up of transmitters or transponders. I'm not sure which is the correct term. But it occurred to me, so I had a question about this. It occurred to me that if, in theory, if the speeds ever got much faster than they are now, that the separation distance-wise between first and second could be greater and the time difference be smaller. Am I wrong there? And the second part of the question is just how long have the cars carried those devices?
Well, the answer to the first thing that you raised, I think that because the cars are identical, so I think they're all in exactly the same place. And so, but as far as how long have they been doing the transponders or the transmitters, I don't know what's correct because I hear both. I don't think I can put a year on that, but it would have been when it was fairly new in the 1990s. So when you had the close finish between Scott Goodyear or Al Jr. And Scott Goodyear, they were fairly new at that time, but I can't give you an exact year. But since you bring it up, and if you don't mind, I'm glad you brought it up, because last night I got to do something that it's amazing you were the first caller, because I was talking to David.
We were talking about this before the show.
Said I hope we can discuss this at some time during the evening, because I got to do something last night that I'd wanted to do for years. I love to moderate panels of drivers and so forth, and for years I thought, wouldn't it be great to sit with Alan Zer Jr. and Scott Goodyear and have the two of them and just hear it from both perspectives. And we did that last night at the museum. And it couldn't have worked out better from my point of view, because they were both so engaging. I think we had about 75, 80 people, and they were hanging on every word, and they were both terrific. And I said afterwards to several people, boy, if you had to edit this down, it would be hard, because I don't think there was a sentence uttered by either of them that wasn't extremely insightful or, you know, passionate or...
Couldn't leave anything on the cutting room floor.
No, I don't think so. No. So...
Well, that's awesome. I know that was an event here kind of in collaboration with the Fan and WIBC as well. And I heard a lot of people from here that worked at that said it was a pretty cool event. So I'm glad it went well last night.
Well, both of the drivers enjoyed it. And Bob Jenkins briefly participated. And so did Derek Walker, who was the entrant for Scott. So you don't get those opportunities very often. And I'm blessed that I was there to... kind of be involved in that one with the two of them.
That's awesome. Hey, John, thank you so much for the question. We go from John in Plainfield to Michael in Plainfield. Michael, what is your question for Donald?
Hey, guys, thanks for having me on tonight. Since Fernando Alonso is competing in this year's Indy 500 and going for the Triple Crown, and this is an ideal situation because his McLaren team and his car is out of contention for the championship, I recently just saw and read where Ayrton Senna in the late 80s, early 90s was driving for McLaren as well, and his car was out of contention for the championship, and he actually test drove Emerson Fittipaldi's Indy car.
That's correct.
And I wanted to know how close Ayrton Senna was to competing in the Indy 500.
Well, I think was like November or December of 92, and Nelson Piquet was going to come. Was it 92 or 93 now? Or was it for the? I'm trying to think if it was for 90. It was for 93. I'm pretty sure.
I'm going to pull Kevin Lee here and look it up.
No. It's okay. No, it was shortly before Christmas, I think, of 92, with a view to doing something in 93. And Fittipaldi was driving for Penske, and I think he had a lot to do with it, knowing Senna. And so the test took place, and it was in Phoenix, but not on the oval. It was at Firebird Raceway, which is a road course, which is on the other side of town. And I've talked to some of the people that were involved in that. There were Penske team members, and I'll withhold names, but one of them, who was a high-ranking Penske person, said when he first heard about it, he thought, oh, you know, there's going to be so much disruption now. We came out here to test. We want to thrash with Fittipaldi, and we want to run a lot of laps, and the press is going to be here, and, you know, there's going to be a lot of, you know, distractions and so on and so forth. He said, I thought he would arrive with an entourage. And he said, so the morning of the test, we're all ready to go, and here comes this little rental car, and it's Fittipaldi driving, and Senna is his passenger, and there's nobody else in the car, and they're already dressed in their uniforms. And so there was clearly great affection between the two of them. And Senna went out and ran a number of laps on the road course, and would come in and give feedback. And they were all immediately very, very impressed with how quickly he adapted. And it was Fittipaldi was anxious to see that happen, because Mansell was going to come. And so
Michael had just left, or was going to leave, for F1.
That was an interesting. It wasn't a planned swap, but it effectively it
kind of ended up that way.
Sure, because Mansell did not defend his 1992 championship and came over and ran here. And Michael went over and ran for McLaren and didn't get the full season in after the Italian Grand Prix.
And it's ironic that he'll go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, he finished third there, and that turned out to be his last race, which is a little bit off of the Senna thing here. But I'll never forget watching the Grand Prix, and Michael really had a rotten year. Several times he was out early, had a couple of finishes, and then an Italian Grand Prix finally gets going. And there was one of the reasons was that he was not allowed to test. And so many of the tracks that he went to, there was some new rule where you can't test in advance. So many of the tracks he went to, he'd never seen before. But Monza, he had run before. And so he finished third, but was right behind the Ferrari that was second, which I think was Alboreto, but I'm not positive about that. And but when he was on the podium, I'm watching on TV and thinking, Michael doesn't look very happy. I mean, he looks like he was about ready to cry. And so then, as it turns out, he already knew that was going to be the Grand Prix, the last Grand Prix that he would run, because let's just say that Mika Hakkinen was going to take over, and politics probably played a little part. Anyway, whatever it was, and I do know some of the details, but anyway, that was Michael's last race. So back onto Senna. So he ran Firebird, and and the fact that Fittipaldi was fantasizing about how many world champions would be in the 500, which I think was going to be four. Because unless I'm missing somebody, it would be Mario, himself, Mansell, and Senna. It would have been four. So anyway, the following day, they went from Firebird over to the Oval, and Senna, for some reason, elected not to run. He just watched. But anyway, there was a... I think on YouTube you can find that there is an interview with a Portuguese reporter, or somebody speaking Portuguese, and interviewing Fittipaldi and Senna. And although you can't understand it, because obviously it's in the foreign language, but the camaraderie between the two of them, And you can see that Fittipaldi is just like he looks a lot like a little kid. It's like he's there with his brother.
I just pulled it up right now. If you literally go on YouTube and type in Ayrton Senna IndyCar test, it's the first video that pops up.
Okay, well, very good. It's very interesting to see that. And then, but nothing came of it because Senna was in contractual negotiations, and it ends up that something came up that was in his favor, so he elected not to come. So as far as I know, it was just on that one day at Firebird Raceway that Senna was in a Penske.
Huh. Well, that's awesome. And I'm watching the video here as you're talking. You can really see the camaraderie and Emerson kind of leaning in and kind of giving him tips and everything. Yeah. It's pretty cool. Hey, Michael, thank you so much for the question, buddy.
Well, thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. We're going to get a quick break here. We'll be right back. We have more with Talk of Gasoline Alley with Donald Davidson on 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm David Deering. Sitting across from me is the historian of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Donald Davidson. And Donald, we were kind of talking during the break, and thank you again, Mike, for your question on Ayrton Senna. And I just thought it was funny. There's been a lot of famous or infamous Penske tests. There's a book by Jade Gerse about the 94 Ilrod Penske engine that's pretty funny, how they were testing the car at Nazareth in secret with that motor, and they were having to climb like snow mounds to see the car. I just thought that was funny. Check out the book if you want. It's a really cool book. But let's get back to questions here. We got George in Bainbridge, Indiana. George, what's your question for Donald?
I would like to know if any driver has ever shown up late for the race on Sunday. And the reason I ask is that I was stuck in traffic one year, and one of the drivers was stuck in traffic with me at about 10:30 on Sunday morning.
Oh, do you know who the driver was?
I believe, and you may have to help me here, but I believe his name was Randy Lewis.
Oh, yeah. So I remember Randy Lewis. I've never heard that story about him, but I do know of some, and specifically 1957 and then several in 1960. So I'm glad this is the beginning of the segment, because I may use up the whole segment on this one.
Please feel free.
All right. Well, one, in 1957, Roger Ward was trying to get to the track, and he lived east of the track at that time, down very close to Lafayette Road and 16th, very, very close to Long's Donuts.
Okay. Yeah.
But I think it was another street, a street or two further west from that. So anyway, he's coming along, and somebody said that they were stuck in traffic, and then they noticed that there was some commotion in the car next to them. And this fellow gets out, and the lady slides across behind the wheel, and it was Roger Ward. And so he actually stood out in the middle of the road, and a wrecker came along, and he flagged it down, and they said, "Oh yeah, hey, you need a ride? Yes, please." And so he jumped up onto the back of the wrecker and hung onto the crane and got taken into the track. So that's 1957. All right, 1960, the Holiday Inn across the street had just opened that February, I think. Brand new. So Roger Ward, there's several things happened. First of all, Eddie Russo got stuck in traffic, and it was getting close to, you know, beginning to think, well, he ought to be here pretty soon. And so not sure if he might get there, because the word was that there was a terrible traffic jam all of the surrounding area. And so they went to the chief steward and said, "We may have to put another driver in the car if he doesn't get here." And they said, "Well, if you do that, you'll have to push the car to last." And so I know that Paul Russo, who was Eddie Russo's uncle, was in the mix, and Mike McGill was in the mix. And I forget which one that they selected, but they did apparently push the car back to last row to start outside in the 11th row. And then Eddie Russo showed up. So then they had to push it back up to its regular starting position. So across the street, the Holiday Inn, Eddie Sachs and Jim Rathman, who were very good friends, were sitting there drinking coffee. And Sachs was on the pole, and Rathman was starting in the middle of the front row. And they're just but coincidence. They're starting 1-2, but they're also very good friends. So they're sitting in a coffee shop having coffee, and time had got away from them. And a fellow named C.B. Smith, who was quite well known around the town, but he was the what they called the innkeeper of that first Holiday Inn, as well as being involved with the timing and scoring at the track and so on and so forth. So anyway, he comes down and says, shouldn't you fellows be getting, you know, it's look, it's almost 10:25 or something. I thought, oh my goodness, oh. So they go running off in different directions. Rathman goes and gets ready to go over to the track, and then he realizes that he actually has six vehicles at his disposal, but realized he didn't have the keys to any of them he'd given them to friends. So, oh my goodness, how do I get to the track? Well, on foot is the answer. And so he came out the front door of the Holiday Inn and then had to go down 16th Street, because in those days, the tunnel that's there between turns 1 and 2 wasn't there yet. The way that you would enter the track off of 16th Street was the tunnel that goes under turn 2 that's still there. So he has to run east down to where the tunnel is, and the Holiday Inn wasn't, Speedway Motel wasn't there yet. So he runs down to the corner of turn 2 and then through the infield, and then finally arrives on foot, and he will end up winning the race. So in the meantime, Eddie Sachs goes up to his room, because he's staying at the Holiday Inn as well, gets his wife, dresses, you know, we got to go. And I forget what the difficulty was with him having transportation as far as a car was concerned, but it ended up that they had to go out onto 16th Street, and along comes a motorcycle cop with the sidecar empty, and Sachs waves him down. The guy recognizes Sachs. Sachs climbs in the sidecar, and his wife gets on his lap. And then they ride down to the turn 2 tunnels, and everything is fine, except the wife doesn't have a credential or a ticket. They had a ticket for her, but they'd given it to her father the night before. So anyway, Sachs was a good talker. The cop talks, and pretty soon they're cleared to go in. And so they get taken through the infield, and Sachs gets out of the garage area and says, all right, honey, you know, you go on in, get down to the front row of the grandstands, and I'll be out in a few minutes, and then I'll come around and I'll be on the pit side, and then we can talk over the fence. In the meantime, Roger Ward is not living east of the track anymore. He's now up approximately 56th and Kessler, with a great street address. He is on the corner. I love this. He's on the corner of Lancelot and Galahad, which is one of those addresses that you would never have to write down. I mean, a wonderful address for a hero like Roger Ward.
Easy to remember.
Right. So he sets off with his wife, and they come down Kessler, and the traffic's all backed up. And finally, they get to 30th Street, and they're inching across 30th Street and inching. And finally, he says, hey, I got to go. So he gets out of the car, just like with the crane incident in 57. Wife slides over behind the wheel, and then Roger goes trotting down, heading west on 30th Street till he gets to the corner of Georgetown, and then down towards 9A, which is the credentials gate. And he's just arriving at 9A, and here comes John Conkle from Conkle's Funeral Home with the ambulance, and says, Roger, you need a ride? And yes. So and he ends up finishing second. This is the day of the great battle between Rathman and Ward, with Ward having to slow down right at the end because of tire wear. And Rathman wins the race with Ward second, and Ward starting on the outside front row. I don't know if I made that clear. So there's Sachs on the pole. He arrives at the track in the sidecar of a motorcycle unit with his wife in his lap. Rathman in the middle of the front row, who will win the race, walks over from the Holiday Inn, and Roger Ward outside of the front row, who was back and forth for the lead and ended up second, he came in John Conkle's ambulance. So did anybody have trouble getting to the race on race morning? Once in a while. I'd never heard about Randy Lewis having difficulties, but one final one. I know on qualifying day in 1966, K.O. Yarborough, I had a chance to spend a little time with K.O. Yarborough a few years ago, and he said on the first qualifying day, he was coming down Georgetown. I think he stayed maybe at the Howard Johnson's, which is long gone. Anyway, he said that they finally we had to park in somebody's yard, and he ended up walking over to the track on the morning of the first qualifying day in 1966.
So obviously a lot of drivers today, they have their RVs and they stay at the track.
Yes.
Where would most drivers stay? Would they stay at hotels? Would they stay at the track somehow?
A mix, and it depends on when you're saying. A lot of them used to stay in
homes. Let's say around that
homes.
Time of when you were mentioning there.
Just prior to that, a lot of the drivers lived with families. Bill Vukovich won the race in 53 and 54. He lived with a family on 15th Street, and Johnny Parsons and Jack McGrath, they walked to the track. The year Johnny Parsons won the race in 1950, he walked over. Jimmy Bryan lived on the corner of 16th and Norfolk. Maybe I shouldn't be so specific with the areas, but he lived at that house for 7 years during the summer. And when he won the race in 58, there's this wonderful story that somebody had driven him over he rode over on a little motorcycle, and coming home, somebody brought him back in a car. He and his wife dropped him off. And Pat O'Connor had lost his life that day, and so Brian was dealing with that. He'd won the race, but perhaps his best friend had lost his life, and so he was dropped off. The wife went in the house, and Jimmy Bryan, still in his yellow Ballon exhaust uniform, Ballon AP mufflers actually it was uniform, lay down in the front yard with the two boys, and that were off the family that lived in that house, and he had a twig, and he would throw it and do fetch with the dog, and the dog would run back, and then he would toss it again, and the people were walking past the house because you could park on Cunningham in those days. And apparently all these people were walking by and looking over, and they just thought it was a mechanic or something. They didn't realize that was Jimmy Bryan in the front yard, who'd won the race that they had seen earlier in the day.
That's awesome. Hey, George, thank you so much for the question, buddy.
Okay. Can I ask one other quick one?
George, we got to get the break, buddy. Try back tomorrow, okay?
All right. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We'll be right back. Talk Gasoline Alley, 107.5, 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. I'm David Deering. Donald Davidson's over there. And George, I know we told you before the break to try back tomorrow, but truthfully, Donald, tomorrow is an email show because, as Kevin Lee says, it's plausibly live. So tomorrow's an email show. And so your next chance to talk to Donald will be Sunday after the race. I believe it's normally you, Kevin Lee, and Greg Rakestraw after the race.
Yes, uh-huh.
So next chance to get a hold of Donald, Sunday after the race. I know you'll either be at the track or you'll be listening, so you'll be listening to the post-race, and they'll give you the heads up on when to call in, and you can do that from there. But let's get back to the phone lines here. We got Terry. Terry from Cleveland, Ohio. Terry, what is your question?
Thank you. Hey, thanks for getting me on. Donald just doing some last-minute packing, heading from Cleveland for a 40-second 500.
Okay, great.
Yeah. My question is, before they went to the full course yellows, they had some type of a yellow pacing light.
Yes.
Can you explain when they started that, how that whole procedure worked, and was it only at Indy, or was it other tracks and road courses? Or
no, it was Indianapolis only, and let's see, when did they start that? I think 75 was the first year. I don't think 74... I've got to think about that for a moment. Anyway, what happened was more and more at other races, the pace car was being deployed to pack the field up. And I know that I was at Milwaukee in 1965 when it was brand new at that time, to the best of my knowledge, brand new. They did it at different races. And so when there was a yellow, the pace car, a pace car would go out and the field would pack up. And the reason was to bring the speeds down, to regulate the speeds, and give the people a chance that if there was an accident, a chance to be able to work without cars speeding by them. And so one by one, it became used at all of the races, I think over a period of like a year or so. But the Indianapolis Speedway still didn't want to do that. And I know that Joe Cloutier, who was Tony Holman's right-hand man and then eventually would become the president of the Speedway after Tony Holman's passing, he thought that there should be a way, because the way it had been was what you were supposed to do. When the yellow came out, you were supposed to note where the car was that was ahead of you, and that you were supposed to all slow down to approximately the same speed, and that throughout the yellow, that the car ahead of you would be the same distance throughout the caution. Well, some drivers were more sporting about that rule than others.
Some wanted to game the system.
And at Milwaukee in 1964, a certain driver, apparently the lap times under the yellow were comparable with the lap times under the green. So that was the reason for the pace car. So anyway, they talked about the drivers wanted to do that at Indianapolis and the officials wanted to do it in Indianapolis. And Joe Cloutier said, I don't think that's fair. And he came up with a way to try and have everybody slow down and hold to the speeds that they were supposed to, because he felt that if you'd built up a sizable lead, it wasn't fair to lose it under caution. And so there were like maybe six stations, if you like, around the track where there was a display board with pit lights. And I think it went 1 to 6. I don't think it went beyond that. It seems to me that it would go 1, 2, 3, up through 6, and then back to 1. And so they were stationed around the track, as I say, like maybe 5 stations or something like that. And so the thinking was that they would set the lights so that when you would go by one, you'd note what number was on it. And if you were running the reduced speed that you were supposed to run, when you got to the next station, you would see the same number. So if it was higher or lower, you would either pick up your speed or reduce it. And so that's what everybody was supposed to do. And they had people that were there to take note and actually do a serial score under yellow to just make sure that everybody was at the number that they were supposed to be. And so there were some people that found ways around that, and one of them was to duck into the pits. And then at some point, finally, a gentleman named Bob Cassidy, who worked for Firestone at one time, and it was a worked for the city of Speedway, was a cop and worked at USAC and a variety of other jobs that he had around town. Anyway, he rode the pace car during the yellows, and he said, can we please close the pits? Because people are ducking in and out, and that it would be better if we had the field packed up and then we would open the pits to let them go in instead of their ducking into the pits while we're trying to pick up the leader and whatever. So I don't remember how long it was before they finally got that done. But I know that 77, 78, they were still doing the pacer light system. And the drivers would say, when Joe Cloutier had said, well, could he... trying to talk too quickly here, and I don't do that very well. Cloutier defended when the driver said, look, we don't care, when he would say, we don't think it's fair that you build up a lead, then you're going to lose it under the yellow by everybody packing up. And they would say, we don't mind because it works at the other races. And although this is a 2.5 mile compared with the miles and the mile and a half that we typically run, or 2 miles in the case of Michigan, or 2.5 miles at Ontario and Pocono, which is another tangent I didn't need to take. But they said, what we lose on one yellow, we'll probably gain on the next one. But anyway, finally, after the 1978 race, for whatever reason, they decided not to do it again. And then in 1979, the pace car went out onto the track during the yellows in Indianapolis. That was the first time that had ever happened.
I imagine also the lights would, I mean, at that time, just let drivers know that there was a caution, because I assume, you know, scanners and radios probably weren't the standard back then for drivers and teams.
Oh, no. Oh, good heavens, no. Two-way radios? No.
When did that start? Do you know?
Well, what?
Like when crew chiefs were able to talk to their drivers and spotters and all that.
Well, that's a whole other subject. But the earliest experiment with two-way radio communication, believe it or not, was 1914.
Wow.
1914, and people would try it from time to time. In 1933, the car that finished fourth, Chet Gardner, with a Samson's radio special. That had radio communication, but it was only one way, and I think it was the pitch talking to the car, in which case, which then was the riding mechanic. I don't think, or maybe they could talk to the pitch, but and the pitch couldn't respond, but I know it was one way only, and it worked apparently fairly well until about two-thirds of the way through the race when a cable broke, and so then they were out. But they continued. People would try it from time to time during practice. Around 80, 81, it was sort of coming in more and more, although there's famous stories there. You had Bobby Unser, for instance, in 1981, had an issue where he would come in from practice and said, look, it doesn't work. And then the mechanic would put the headset on and play around and say, well, it's working now. And he said, yes, because we're in the pits. But when we're on the track, it doesn't work. And so he had it all set up that he had a good pit board man. And sure enough, the thing pitched during the parade or pace lap. And so he used pit board for the rest of the day to win the race. But I would say that probably by 83, 84... by that time, I think everybody was pretty much doing the two-way radios. But anyway, prior to that, 1935 is when the yellow lights came in, yellow and green lights for the first time, so then you would know to slow down. But the pacer light was I think, 75 through 78. It might have started a couple of years before that, but definitely 78 was the last year, and then 79 they went to the base car.
Okay, I'll tell you what, let's get a quick break here. Hey, Terry, thank you for the question, buddy.
Thanks, Donald. Hey, we'll be listening to you after the race Sunday, after Graham wins.
Okay, thank you.
I have him in my driver pool, so that's who I'm pulling for as well. Hey, thank you so much, Terry. We're going to get a quick break here, and when we come back, we'll try to get a few more calls in here, the last segment of the show. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley. I'm David Deering. That's Donald Davidson over there. This is 107.5 and 1070 The Fan. This is the Talk of Gasoline Alley, 107.5, 1070 The Fan. I'm David Deering. Donald Davidson is over there. And before we get back to the phone lines, yeah. Donald, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, I just, in case we run out of time at the end, I just want to thank everybody for calling in and supporting us again. And I wish we had more time. I wish we could get in more callers. But, you know, if the question was, what was the winning, you know, what color was the winning car in 1965? Green. Next question, please. But I just like to tell stories. And I wish I didn't have to talk as quickly as I do to try and get everything else, to get it all in. But, you know, maybe we can come out and visit your community since those visits have become so successful. Maybe we can be doing that and, maybe come to your area if there's enough interest. We don't want to come and sit, with two or three people. But if you can get an event with 7,500, 150 people or something, we'd like to come. But anyway, we will be doing a little bit after the race. And I'm sorry that we're basically out of time now. We did an email show for tomorrow. And then Friday, there isn't a show because of the Burger Bash, or Saturday because there will be other programming going on. But again, thank you to everybody for your support over the years. We've been doing this quite a while now, and apparently the novelty hasn't worn off. And, hopefully we can come back and do it again next year, and maybe we can get some more time.
And we'll be back in what, July for the Brickyard, too?
Yes.
So we'll kind of...
I believe we're going to do a week then, I think. I don't know that that's settled yet, but...
I assume we'll be doing something, so okay. Look forward to that. I just wanted to thank you. I've been with this show... I want to say for the past 4 or 5 years, and it's cool for me just to be just a small part of a of this show. It's fantastic.
Well,
and you've been
David.
Awesome. Kevin, Kurt, everybody here, everybody at IMS, they've been really nice to me and everybody that listens to the show. So thank you. And Donald, thank you again.
All right, David. All right, thanks. We'll see if we can squeeze in a couple
absolutely.
Here.
Hey, let's get to Raymond in Stanford, Connecticut. Raymond, what is your question for Donald?
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
Fine.
Doing well.
Good. I have a question about a driver by the name of George Howie.
Yes, George Howie, it's funny you bring that one up. George Howie ran in 1931 with the GNH special, and golly, I hadn't thought about this one for a while. He was 11th in 1930, and then 32 and 33 didn't qualify, but he did get in as a relief driver. That it was the GN8 special, if I didn't mention that, and that was his initials, George N. I forget what the N stood for, and the H was for Howie. And golly, I think that had a Chrysler power plant. I hadn't thought about that one for a while. Anyway, he did not qualify in 32 or 33, but he did get in as a relief driver in 1933 for Russ Snowberger and the Russell 8 special. Which finished eighth, and a daughter of George Howie's came to the photo shop on the second floor of the museum building, probably about 10 years ago, and I think she said that he was born in Syria or somewhere like that, but clearly with a
did a Wikipedia search and it says he's from Syria. So
well, he was born there, but yeah. That's you did Wikipedia while
Wikipedia,
I was talking here.
Yeah.
Okay,
I was looking for his middle initial or his middle name.
Well, I don't know that you'll find that, but anyway, he was born in Syria, but with a Scottish name. I assume that was British parents, but and he was from at the time that he ran, I think Brooklyn, New York, or somewhere like that, I believe. That's about all I can tell you about George Harry.
Hey, Raymond, thank you so much, man.
Thank you.
All right, let's our final call. Final call of the month is actually probably pretty appropriate. Paul and Racine.
Hello, Paul.
Donald, let me just say that it's just been truly, again, just a blessing, and I think I, you know, just really enjoy it and look forward to it, and it just always goes way too fast, but thank you, and just, you know, please take care of your health, and, you know, you're just a treasure, and I'm
all right, Paul, thank
really
you.
Blessed to have listened all these years. And hopefully next time I hear you talk, you'll be talking about the significance of a four-time winner. So we'll save that for later. But
okay.
In the last year, we've lost a real iconic car owner in Carl Haas.
Yes.
And I'd like you to talk a little bit about Carl. You know, the fact that he never won the 500, I think, is just kind of tragic. But also, can you confirm a story? I had heard that, you know, he always chewed on those cigars during a race. And I had heard that if he won that race, if his team won that race, he'd have a box made with, you know, engraved with the date and who won and the event. And he would put that chewed up cigar in a box.
I never heard that. Okay. No, I never heard that. And I forget what the stats ended up, but at one time, it was amazing that the number of laps that team had led, and they never won it. And they had Michael finishing second in 91, but they led so many laps with Mario and with Michael.
Michael dominated 92, didn't he?
He dominated in 92, and then also... let's see.
Mansell?
Well, yeah, I was trying to think of other years when Nigel led a lot of laps, but Mansell as well. And there was something like somebody from Newman Haas called me one time, and I hadn't thought about this. They had led something like 600 and something laps, but with very few drivers. There was only like four or five drivers because they started in 83 with Mario, one car, and then it was Mario for a while, And then they added Michael. And then when Michael went to Europe, and then Mansell came on board for 2 years. And then when Michael came back, he went with Ganassi. And eventually there was a few other drivers. But I know that one time I hadn't thought about the fact that they led so many laps. But Carl Haas was the distributor for Lola, and he lived in Chicago. I think he was born in Germany, although that a lot of the sources said he was born in Chicago, but there's an indication that he did not. And he drove sports cars, and he was quite involved with SCCA in a managerial role at one time. And then, his distributorship with Lotus goes way back to long before they were at Indianapolis. But anyway, can we squeeze another quick one in?
We can do one more. William, let's try that. William in St. Louis. William, really quickly, buddy, what's your question?
Yes, I know that Fernando Alonso had not run any ovals before he got to Indianapolis. What about Graham Hill in 66? Has he had prior oval experience?
No. No, I would say that Jim Clark in 63, Brabham in 61, except that Brabham had driven in Australia what they call down there speed cars. We called them midgets, but he'd never had experience on an oval other than for testing. And I think that's probably true of all of the fellows that came over from Christian Lautenschlager and Bacunin Barzacchini. I don't think they'd ever run an oval before. And then, then anybody else, Regazzoni probably would not have, Michele Alboreto, Alberto Ascari. I could keep going on and on and on. Dennis Holm, Jochen Rindt, Mastin Gregory, an American, Dan Gurney, Americans who came through Formula One. But I would say that Alonso follows in a long line of people. Jackie Stewart would never have run an oval until he came and tested in the spring of 66.
Fantastic. Hey, William, thank you so much for the question, buddy.
Okay.
And that should just about do it, actually. Hey, Donald, thank you once again.
Thank you, David.
It's been a great month of shows. If you missed anything, we have it on our iTunes page. It's up on the website, 1070thefan.com. We have every track site, every Talk of Gasoline Alley. Go back and listen to that. I think also on iTunes, we have ones from years ago. So you can go back and listen to all of those. Like we said, tomorrow, email show, so plausibly live. Donald's back after the race on Sunday. We're still on the air tomorrow, though. So 7 o'clock to 8, track site. 8 to 9 will be Donald with Kevin. And live Sunday after the race.
Well, and of course, we'll be on during the race as well.
Absolutely. I'll have my race scanner on in turn three listening.
All right, good for you. Well, anyway, I hate to gallop, but we have to do that to try and get as much as we can. And once again, I want to thank everybody for listening and for calling and for the comments that we get throughout the year. Bless all of you, and I hope we can keep doing this.